just a girl caught up in dreams and fantasies. Please see me reaching out for someone I can see.
Take hey, Nathaniel.
Good morning, Nick. We're off to a little bit of a late start this morning, and we're on our own. Welcome back to the Film Experience Podcast. I'm your host, Nathaniel, and I'm here with Nick Davis from Nick's Flick Picks.
I get to talk twice as much.
Yay!
Woo!
No more of those spotlight hoggers trying to steal it from you.
It's down to two of us.
So yeah, you can't really... Well, you can see and steal if there's only two people. As we discovered in Doubt.
That's right. I'll just cover my whole face with my wimple and turn away constantly and just hand you the scene if you would like. Act like I'm giving it to you instead of you're just taking it.
All right. So we have not talked about contemporary cinema in a while because we've been doing all these special podcasts. I know everybody's been enjoying them, so thank you so much for being into them and commenting and stuff. But we're going to return to contemporary cinema for the moment. Let's start with Begin Again.
I loved it.
Yeah.
But, you know, at first, we've kind of signaled that we both had some of this reaction. We haven't really talked about it. I think we both started out going, oh, no.
Yeah.
And actually, we saw once together in the theater, right?
Uh-huh.
AMC Empire years ago.
Yeah.
So, feels fitting to be talking about this now. So, yeah, I don't... What wasn't working for you at the beginning, and when did it get better?
It's tough to say when it got better. Maybe I just, like, accepted it.
Yeah.
Because when it looped... For those who haven't yet seen the movie, this isn't really a spoiler because it's the beginning of the movie, but one of the very earliest scenes is Keira Knightley performing in a bar. And she's non-famous, so it's like an open mic type of thing. And then you loop back to that about 15 minutes later, 10, 15 minutes
yes,
later.
Yes, yeah.
And you see the scene again from a different perspective. And it was, even during that, so that's like the first 15 minutes, even when you came back around for the second perspective, I was kind of annoyed because I thought it was so tricked up.
Right.
Because Mark Ruffalo, who plays the music agent, is basically hearing her song, but with all this extra orchestration that's not in the room. So, because he's a producer, so he's imagining it. And even then, I was like, oh, this is so cheesy, but I'm not sure what happened, but I just suddenly found it endearing. I think it was actually her reticence to, like, it didn't seem like a meet cute convention, or she didn't even seem like she was willing to go along with the movie.
Right.
like, she was all prepared to walk away from the conversation, which I thought was just a very welcome sort of vinegary reaction to all that what had seemed very sweet and forced at the beginning.
Yes. And his off-puttingness, which I found to be a real problem as we're getting to know that character, that we are obviously, we've talked many times about liking actors or performances that are not begging you to adore them, but mm-hmm. it was maybe too much. But then once he had, she's not an adversary, but once you had that different energy to play off of, it became more interesting that he was as abrasive as he was.
Mm-hmm. But even his abrasiveness is not played as that he thinks it's an unlikable character.
Right.
Like, there's a certain smugness to it, dare I say. And I'm beginning to question whether or not that's creeping into a lot of Mark Ruffalo's work.
Mm-hmm.
Which I feel bad saying because he is one of my favorite actors, but lately I've just had trouble with him.
I liked him in The Normal Heart more than you did, but there is a bit of a House style that's starting to happen. Like, I appreciate that he doesn't go for big effects, but by the time we meet him on screen, it feels as though he has absorbed all of his thoughts about the character in such a way that they do come off as really casual in the way you're talking about, that he's not working at being off-putting. It's just happened. But I don't know how to phrase it better than you already did.
And how did you feel about the sort of periphery characters? So you have Adam Levine, who's playing Keira Knightley's boyfriend. He's the rock star. And his career has taken off. So at the beginning, you know, she's sort of tagging along through everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have her roommate slash best friend, played by James Corden.
I liked all of them. I liked Hailee Steinfeld as the daughter, too. Again, maybe not immediately. But I think that part of what accounted for how fully I fell in love with the movie at a certain point was that those early scenes seemed like we happen to be in the music business, but if it weren't the music business, we've seen the scene a million times where one partner is being kicked out of a business by the other partner who's made it successful, and fuck you, I'm taking the painting, and I'm embarrassing myself in front of my daughter and in front of my former partner. But all of that could have been anything. And then the scenes where Adam Levine and Keira Knightley are meeting with the record company, and he's kind of trying to get her a better deal, and she's trying very hard not to seem like this, like the partner trying to get a good deal. Like, all of that felt a lot more specific. And the relationship with James Corden and his apartment and how you live when you're trying to make music that much a part of your life, all of that felt much more kind of specific to this story. And I got super into it. And that strenuousness that you were talking about at the beginning is just gone. Every performance just seems so relaxed at that point.
It almost made me wonder if the movie was shot in sequence.
Yeah.
Because I was like, how is this getting so much better as it goes along? And I've heard some people complain about the ending.
Right.
Because, you know, the movie is not a plot movie. It's just sort of like a slice of life. But the plot sort of gives way to just a series of musical performances and these interactions between the characters.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have a problem with the way it sort of... It ends with an ellipsis, basically.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about the very, very ending, the epilogue? Or the...
In general, like...
Or right before, okay.
Yeah. It just didn't feel wrapped up.
Mm-hmm.
So much as so an ellipsis.
Does it bother you that's an example of the kind of thing you could say about Once as well, and there are many things you could say about this movie narratively and in the way it's made that you could say about Once? Did it feel too much like a copycat to you?
Not exactly. The relationships actually did feel different to me.
Mm-hmm.
It is definitely sort of a Hollywood cousin to
mm-hmm.
to Once. I think Once is a masterpiece, maybe, mm-hmm. of its type, very specific type of what it's doing.
Yeah.
And Once's ending feels is completely transcendent, which is not true here.
Mm-hmm.
This is more just an amiable movie.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel at all masterful to me. I just enjoyed it so much, if that makes sense. And I liked ideas fleshed out that I don't normally see fleshed out. Like, for example, the song Lost Stars,
mm-hmm.
which Kira's character writes for Adam Levine's character.
Mm-hmm.
And then she objects to the way it's actually performed.
Right.
Which is not something I can recall seeing in a movie.
Completely. And to hear it, not only do you hear it four times, right? You hear her sort of say the lyrics,
mm-hmm.
and then you hear the arrangement she'll always like the best, and then a horrible one, and then something...
In the middle.
Right. And even that first time where you're hearing her read the lyrics, I think I expected that song is going to come back later just because of how it's positioned in the story, but it's not... super flaunting the fact that here's the first of four big scenes where you hear the same song. You only gradually kind of discover that that's the song that's really taken off. And
mm-hmm.
There was so much about even there, as you learn what an amazing success he's had, the movie still plays things kind of close to the cuff, which I really enjoyed. And she's the primary reason that I think the whole movie feels that way. She's just so
relaxed.
Yeah.
And the doing that, it sort of opens up all these, it feels like a complete characterization, but not like she's trying.
Exactly.
Which means she won't get very much credit for it, but because it's too effortless. But I was just I think it's the best performance she's given, actually.
I kept thinking about, and I know this will sound like overpraise to some fans, but I just kept thinking about Juliette Binoche a lot as one of the only other actors I could think of who's that good at just calming a movie down and seeming like you're exploring the character but not making any big fuss about it, and just seems so incredibly comfortable in her skin. It was just such a pleasure to spend time around her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is actually quite a reversal after A Dangerous Method.
Right.
It was just so recent.
Right.
She
seems like she's interested in the same kind of trajectory of working with some directors who push her really far into mannerism, and then recently just seeming to be in several projects in a row where she's all about exploring relaxation, and that strikes me as a kind of Binoche Kidmany thing to do too.
I feel like we're maybe living that Vanity Fair cover with Tom Ford and Kira and Scarlett.
Not for the first time, I'm sure.
We're kind of living it, only Tom Ford is the director, and both of them are just like... This is a tortured analogy, but both of them are just stripping themselves bare over and over again in their latest movies.
Although in the case of this movie, I feel like she's the Tom Ford whispering in Ruffalo's and Carney's ear, like, it's cool, we've got this, just calm down, we're going to get it, everything's fine. Let's just look great. I've got these fantastic dresses, everything is going to be wonderful in this movie.
We're going to ask IMDb to change to uncredited as Keira Knightley director.
Right.
Before we begin again. One other point about the musical performances, and that's being something we hadn't seen before, and the way it's the thing that I was really impressed with that about, and with the whole movie in general, is it felt like things artists might actually be concerned about.
Yes.
That, and then you wonder, why haven't I heard this before?
And then how many other character beats they communicate by playing or writing or listening to music with each other.
Mm-hmm.
In the kind of reunion scene she has with Adam Levine, and the scene where Mark Ruffalo makes her walk through the city listening to whatever's on the headphones, and all of in the scene where she finds out what's going on that she didn't know about from Adam Levine, and all of those felt really plausible to me and did mean that I almost completely overcame my allergy to montages in movies where I'm just supposed to swoon about New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. But and this is a movie that's all about quirkily making music outdoors, and it's the wonder of New York City, and I was still totally with it, which is kind of amazing.
Yeah, so we recommend everybody see it.
Yeah.
If you haven't yet. I mean, it's been doing fairly well, so a lot of you have probably seen it.
Yeah, 11 million I read yesterday so far. That's pretty great for that film.
Yeah.
Especially because of Toronto, it just went down like this wet, I don't even know a good noun, wet sock. I didn't hear anything good about it. And then they waited a whole year and changed the title to something way worse. I mean, every sign was that this was not going to go well, and it's just such a pleasant surprise.
Yeah, I mean, it's the type of movie, it doesn't have a lot of artistic pretensions, even though it says smart things about art, but it doesn't come off like it has artistic ambition, which I think at a festival is always a tricky place to inhabit,
right.
Unless you're very glitzy. You know, you can do the, like, full studio, you know, glam prestige project that isn't actually ambitious and get away with it, but that middle ground is dangerous territory, I think.
Right. And it may actually be a case where going to the blander title is also a wise move, right? Because calling your movie Can a Song Save Your Life is just asking for it.
Yeah. Yeah, the review headlines would have, you know... They probably did write themselves if we look back.
Right.
So, basically, I have had a great summer at the movies. And I know that the box office is down...
Yeah,
But I have enjoyed so many things. We're going to wait and talk about Boyhood until the next podcast.
I do want people to know I suggested talking about Boyhood for 4 minutes apiece for each of the next 22 podcasts. For some reason, no one is listening to me.
It would be even more ambitious if we just recorded it 5-minute podcast every year until its 10th anniversary.
I think we should do that.
But I know that you have not had as pleasant this summer because I've looked at your grades. And I think one movie we're very divided on is Snowpiercer, I think.
Right. I don't think I've had a bad summer. I haven't really seen a lot, it feels like. And a lot of the things that that I have seen are actually things I saw a while ago that are only now opening. Mm-hmm. And Snowpiercer is a funny case. Like, Snowpiercer is a great example of the reason that I brought back that feature of the site where I give movies a grade, but I also give them a ranking based on...
I was actually going to bring that up. That was the next...
it or not?
That was the next point I was going to bring up.
Yeah. Because to me, I mean, these two movies together are a perfect illustration of I just enjoyed the heck out of Begin Again and think it's really good at doing what it's doing. And if you're only going to go see one of those movies, you should probably go see Snowpiercer. If you're looking to react to something really divisive and ambitious for itself. It would be hard to even isolate an element of Snowpiercer that I got excited about, but I do admire the endeavor. But you really liked it a lot, or liked the best parts a lot?
Yeah, I liked the best parts a lot. I do not think it's perfect in any way, shape, or form. I was just so taken with its sort of... it's just momentum and its energy and its bravado about this very strange... it has elements of, like, many, many different genre movies, but it feels like its own unique thing, and it's in your face about it.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked that sort of confidence, which with violent movies I don't always respond to well. Oh, you just love sadism, and so, you know.
Right.
But I really liked this one. But I think we should step back a second, and you should maybe explain VOR to people, because you haven't updated a lot, and some readers might not be aware of this, because you haven't done it in a long time.
Oh, yeah, so I call it VOR just because that's an acronym for value, originality, and risk. So when I think probably anybody listening to this podcast and anybody on it is asked all the time, what's out that I should go see? And it feels like you might have two sets of answers to that, like movies that you think really fulfilled what they set out to do for themselves, and then movies that, whether or not you love them, feel really important to have an opinion about or test yourself against. And so sometimes the same movie like 12 Years a Slave or Gravity might be super high on both of those registers. But sometimes there's, for me, like a Noah or a Snowpiercer that I really don't enjoy or even disrespect as an experience, but I admire what was attempted.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
and when did you first do this? Was it... did Chris Nolan cause it, like he caused the Oscars to change
things?
Yes,
immediately after Inception. I mean, and that was when I went home and thought, okay, there has to be something else to say besides C-. And it had to do with also writing so many fewer full reviews, but it felt like a way to give people a little more information.
Mm-hmm. And I recall that one of the biggest divides you've ever had is also Inglourious Basterds. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, I love that system. I realize it's hard to put over in
a soundbite.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I love it because I have often felt like, well, yeah, I gave it a B minus. Like, B minus is my sort of pleasure zone of movies that I didn't at all really dislike, but they don't really work, but I'm fascinated by them type of thing.
Right.
Like, I remember the movie I had the hardest time dealing with in terms of a grade was Black Dahlia.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was so thrilled, even though I thought it was bad a lot of times.
Yes.
And so that I gave it a B- or whatever, but of course I've thought about that movie way more than movies are graded higher afterwards.
Right. And I feel like this comes back to roost when you make your lists at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And taking the 10 movies that you technically gave the 10 highest grade to often doesn't look right.
Right. And then people complain, like, but why isn't this in your top 10? You gave it a, you know, B+
right.
or A-.
Right.
But the top 10 is very, it feels historical. It feels like if you mess it up, you're in trouble.
I am making my mark with this top 10 that I still haven't released from last December.
Right. So I guess with Snowpiercer, given, you know, that we both feel the same way about it, about whether or not people should see it.
Mm-hmm.
But we liked different parts of it, maybe. What Do you have a favorite part of it?
I was curious to ask you the same thing, especially because strangely I felt my needle didn't really move that much. Putting Ewan Bremner's arm out into the outside air or things where, I mean, the scene starts and you know right away where it's going, but I haven't seen that as an example of kind of totalitarian punishment before. So there were a couple standout moments like that, but it was a really pretty consistent, I like what we're trying for and I just can't get behind this. And that almost everything in the movie to me seems to be emphasizing the class metaphor or power allegory, which seems so clear already from the premise that for me it just mystified me that people wouldn't see their job as making that more detailed or subtle or putting over other things, because the allegory is clearly going to take care of itself. And I just, all the heightening just sat poorly with me and confused me about the scenario of how I didn't really believe I was in that train. I was confused about why it was so elaborate, but also why this was so, I felt like I was getting one story about an incredibly doted over object that its architect had designed in this ridiculously elaborate way, but also a story about an emergency in which a bunch of people packed onto a train, lickety split, are the only people surviving. So the fussiness and the happenstance of everything that happens made no sense to me. And
see, I didn't have any problem with suspension of disbelief because I didn't think the movie cared whether or not it was believable.
I don't think so either. Again, it seems to mostly want to work as a metaphor, right?
Which is why I didn't have any problem with that, you're saying.
But it confused me about, I didn't actually feel immersed in the environment of it, believable or not, which was a bigger problem. And it confused me about just some character points about how selected or not selected did these people feel for being on the train, or what are they remembering about the terms under which they got on this thing that they're now protesting? That was where it started to bug me. But I agree with you, it's not asking to be plausible at all.
I mean, my favorite thing about it, since that's what you're asking, I do have a favorite thing about it, and it's really hard to describe, but it's the structural way it uses the train and its forward motion. There's something about, not vertiginous, the other thing.
Velocity?
Yeah, and the fact that each doorway is like a short film. And it sort of illustrates linearity in a fun way, I think. I just loved that sort of, I never knew what was going to be behind the next door, so it felt not like a pick-your-own-adventure, but just a sort of a blunt force pressing onward. And that momentum felt extremely well sustained for me. Even though I will readily admit that the further we got into the train, the more problems I had with the movie. And also, I did believe we were in. I loved the direction in terms of where the camera would go and how it would follow people. And all of that contributing to that sort of rushing forward, especially in the action scene.
I liked one of the most powerful moments to me in sort of figuring out how to stage an action movie in that compressed a space was when they are having to sort of lunge forward with the battering ram really early, and there's no room for people to be on either side of it. So what are they going to do? And so just watching the choreography of people having to advance the thing and then people run on top of it and then people sort of scooch under it, that was all pretty cool. Like, those were moments where I felt like everything I was watching was governed by the conceit of the movie. But then maybe you're right that it was a little bit about advancing through, but something about there being a huge morgue and a giant queer disco, or it just felt like the scale of where we were. I mean, again, I totally agree. They're not asking us to take this as plausible, but the sense of being in a constrained environment just dissipated at regular intervals for me, even kind of the school. There are so many things. I agree that this movie, for as blunt as it is, it's weirdly hard to talk about. And I feel like a lot of the nerves that it's touched are hard to talk about, because one thing I was sitting there thinking about was just my response to a lot of Korean cinema, because at least a lot of the Korean stuff that opens over here mm-hmm. is usually pretty brazen, and it's...
Yeah.
Like, we watched Old Boy together years ago, yeah. And
this actually did remind me of that.
Yes.
And you recall I hated Old Boy.
Yes.
Which is not... a common reaction.
Although you did a better job than I did of staying awake during it. But and then I just rewatched it maybe a couple months ago. And just trying to wrap my head around the foreignness of foreign language movies and what the relative balance of just impact versus integration mm-hmm. versus something that's kind of tempting to call... tastelessness. Like, there are a lot right. of Korean movies lately that seem pretty interested in flouting your conception of what you can deal with or right. what makes sense in the scenario. So I was trying to figure out how to be in good faith with the movie, because there were some times where I just thought, this is so tacky, or where the outrageous artificiality of the snow world that I thought was way under budgeted compared to everything that had been lavished on the train sets. Mm-hmm. The ice world just looked awful to me. Like, the CGI of all of that, or the mm-hmm. the atmospherics of it didn't get to me. But I also don't know if that even matters, mm-hmm. which is why I would... It's a rare movie that I was actually wishing I was seeing it with somebody else.
Right. Okay. To better process afterwards type of thing.
Yeah. Or just, hash it out. Mm-hmm. Even Tilda Swinton, who you would think would be an island of uncomplicated admiration. It's like, I loved that she had figured out how to be in a Bong Joon-ho movie and go totally over the top without being boring. But at the same time, there was a way in which I wasn't super into what she was doing. Mm-hmm.
One of the commenters, and I apologize that I've forgotten who, because I did want to give them credit for this, mentioned that she felt like that she was actually playing a live-action version of an anime character.
Uh-huh.
Which I thought was really smart, because she, even, like, the body language felt cartoonish, but in a very specific cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not just that broad, over-the-top cartoonish.
Right, right.
So I went back and forth with her,
mm-hmm.
And I don't in particularly love any particular performance in it. It's more just, I loved the experience of watching it and mm-hmm. that it just engaged me in a way that I haven't been engaged in a while.
I agree.
So I recommend that everybody see that. It's available on VOD very controversially already.
Yeah. And it does change in ways, not just the way the kind of environment changes, but there are different ideas about how the power of the train is working at the end and at the beginning.
Yeah.
And again, for a movie that has seemed so gleefully overt about what it's claiming for a while, it is interesting to then have to rethink what you have been watching, in mm-hmm. a sense.
I had one more thing to say. Oh, I did want to ask how do you feel about Bong Joon-ho in general? Do you have feelings about his career? I mean, you had mentioned Korean cinema, but do you like him as a director?
I loved Mother. I think we both did.
Yeah.
I really disliked his entry in that Tokyo movie a few years ago. Mm. Did you see that?
I did not.
The host, I love what I would call the best parts. Like, that was an experience for me that was a little bit up and down, but definitely tilted positive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's all I've seen. I haven't seen Memories of Murder.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I would recommend to anybody who likes Snowpiercer that you have to see Mother.
Yes.
But I would also recommend Mother to people who hate Snowpiercer, because Mother is just freaking incredible.
Yes. And didn't Park Chan-wook, who did Old Boy and Thirst and stuff, didn't he produce this or something?
Snowpiercer?
Yeah. That might be wrong, but I thought I remembered that from the credits. Because it did feel like an amalgam of their... Yeah, I'm looking it up right now, and it says he was the producer.
Oh, you're right, yeah.
And there are parts of it that feel more like a Park Chan-wook movie than a Bong Joon-ho movie to me, even mm-hmm. though I'm still kind of figuring out what that means.
Yeah. And, you know, since you went there, Park Chan-wook, my favorite film of his is easily Thirst.
Mm-hmm, me too.
But, yeah, I would have trouble... I wouldn't immediately watching a movie know which one directed it because I haven't seen enough of their oeuvres. So I agree with you that. And there is sort of that genre sadism streak through both of their work.
Right. Can I ask you one more question about it?
Yeah, yeah.
When I said that this movie seems to touch all these buttons that are difficult to react to, I realized also that I might not think Harvey Weinstein is wrong, that it could have been tighter or, you know, no one's... Or let's say very few people are probably going to know what exactly are the cuts that he was suggesting or tones he wanted to emphasize. Mm-hmm. But he's so the boy who cried, fuck you, that it's hard to hear him say fuck you to any director now and not think he's just being a corporate, mm-hmm. you know...
A-hole.
Whatever. and that we're all well-trained to think that if the studio is telling the artist to change their movie, that the artist is always right. But I did sort of sit there wondering... whether my allegiance was clear to me in that moment. Like, I was really interested in looking at such a forceful artistic statement, even though it seemed to me it could use some processing. But it's awfully hard to say I'm with Harvey, but it suddenly seems easy to say I'm not with Harvey, or well, he couldn't possibly have a perspective on this.
Well, at this point, I don't even know which version... Like, I didn't follow the story well enough to know which version I just saw.
They're telling us that this is the one that's played everywhere.
So this is the long version?
Unmodified, yes.
Oh. I mean, I'm not sure that I have a feeling about that, other than that I agree that it's not, you know, heresy, I know, in our auteurist culture, but I agree that it's not always the case that the director's cut is the right cut. Mm-hmm. And it's primarily, I used to always believe that, but it was primarily, you know, DVD, Blu-ray extras, culture that taught me that's not always the case. Sometimes they get really flabby because people get really precious about things that they worked on.
Right.
And movies, I forget which director, I guess it was Orson Welles, like movies can never be too short.
Mm-hmm.
Which I kind of feel like if you haven't tightened each scene
right
as tight as it needs to go, you need to do more work on it.
Right.
Unless your entire point is the looseness, in which case you have a very specific type of movie, but very few movies should be going for that.
And this movie is such a crazy blend of tight and loose, right? Like, you feel the amount of focus or at least vehemence that's gone into every choice it's making, but it is also scrawling all over the place in certain ways, which mm-hmm. I'm kind of glad nobody cleaned that up. And some commenter will help us if we're wrong about this. I felt like the basic tenor of that discussion was that Harvey Weinstein wanted to tighten it as an action movie and help audiences through some of the tonal vacillation that a Korean audience might be totally primed for, but we're not quite so used to, but also maybe tamp down the... I can't imagine him being happy about the amount of conversation with Ed Harris
right
near the end of this, right?
Yeah. And that scene was a little flat for me, actually.
Me too. Even Ed Harris was a little flat
for
me, which is not what I usually say.
Yeah.
But then it gets to, like, do you want a quote-unquote better movie, or do you want a more provoking experience, which I think are... at least it makes me think that the contest between them might have actually been interesting and two legitimate points of view instead of just David and Goliath.
Mm-hmm. So we have one more movie that we'll race through. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Now this one has gotten, you know, just raves. And I haven't been paying enough attention online lately, so I don't actually know where you are on this one. But My thing with it, I loved Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Mm-hmm.
And my thing with this one is I was totally enjoying it all the way through, but I never really responded to it that this is special, and then people have been just going crazy for it. So I need to know where you are and why.
I also enjoyed it all the way through. I think that orcs and zombies and apes should not talk. So I... It's like, everybody shut up, especially when it got to the funny point where when an ape wants to say something really deep or heartfelt, they say it in English. And David A can just be, but if I really want to tell my son what he needs to hear, I'm going to say it. It was weird. But I was with it. I apparently didn't like Rise of the Planet of the Apes all that much. I don't remember it very well. And every time anybody describes it to me now, it does sound way more interesting than the movie I just saw and enjoyed better. But Dawn of the Planet of the Apes I saw a week ago, and it already feels pretty remote to me. I can't even account for how it filled 2 hours, because there are moments in it that I love, like watching from beneath as the apes are leaping through the trees, or some of the visuals of the big battle, I guess, in the human outpost.
And for me, seeing the apes on horseback is such a weirdly resonant image.
Yeah. The delineation of the standoff at the beginning seemed really promising, and watching the apes really reluctantly help people who they're pretty sure don't fundamentally have their interests at heart. Like, it was all kind of interesting. It never seemed to maybe totally capitalize on its potential to be interesting, which might be why it's hard to remember. Like, I like that it opened a few cans of worms. I'm not in love with... I'm not even sure how far any of them got.
Mm.
The gun stuff.
Yeah. I mean, that scene, I will say the first... and the whole movie hinges on people firing guns.
Yeah.
But because that first standoff is so powerful, and that's about the way people are quick to pull triggers.
Right.
But... I will say that the scene with Koba, where he goes and pretends to be a stupid ape,
amazing,
is an amazing scene.
Yes,
and completely scared me.
Yes,
I'm sure I was grabbing, doing the cliche of grabbing the arm.
Yes,
the arms of the seat.
Both times.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
And I love when they're first going to spy before. Because you see the scene twice essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But it changes on the second time. But
right,
just seeing them out of focus, swinging towards them, hanging from the ceiling, was an amazing image.
Yep.
And then the far more intimate scene where the camera's closer and he's doing his little, you know, pantomime of
right.
of this is what you think apes are, you know.
And he's slightly familiar to them at that point.
Yeah.
Right.
That scene is incredible. It's easily one of the best scenes of the year.
Yeah.
But I just didn't feel that way all the way through, and I certainly didn't feel it looking back on the movie.
Yeah.
And I was talking to Amir about this, who really did not like it.
Uh-huh.
And I was surprised, because I thought, well, everybody just kind of likes it, right? And we didn't discuss it in great detail, but he just felt like what did it even advance? Were that at the same place we were at the end of Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
We're still not to this, you know, the world dominated by apes.
Right.
You know, it's like the middle problem of franchises.
Mm-hmm. But also, especially maybe in relationship to Snowpiercer, it's a challenge thinking about different ways to like a movie. Because I feel like I reacted the way that you're describing. There were moments in which I know I was completely pulled into it. Maybe not in a way that is still 100% with you an hour after you've left the theater, or that you can revisit and get more out of. But there's something to be said for how... I think the movie's really handsome. I thought the handling of light and color and movement was often really enticing. That's not something you're going to dwell on later, but it created a really good cocoon while I was there.
Right.
And then... that whole franchise is so well known at this point for being so blatantly a political commentary.
Yeah.
Yeah, that having single scenes like those that put all those characters, but also the ideas they stand for into such charged combinations can be a way to think about what you want your movie to do, like versus advance the giant arc of the franchise mm-hmm. in the way that the Star Wars movies are constantly trying to do recently, but with none of the kinds of scenes that you think about on their own terms. Like, it's all about getting from A to B. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so that wound up feeling like it was enough, even though I've been kind of retrenching on my feeling about it and on my grade since I left, because it's evanescing a lot faster than I thought it would.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think the one problem for me is that Caesar seemed really uninteresting to me in this movie. Mm-hmm. And the Caesar versus Koba, that whole narrative, I basically didn't like. And it increasingly felt like the center of the film. Mm-hmm. I didn't find close-ups of Caesar remotely revealing. I didn't find his participation in the story to be interesting. I know people sometimes hate this way of thinking, but it did seem like the movie really, really wanted to have a fair-skinned ape with green eyes who gets the last close-up in the movie, and a son called Blue Eyes, who's the good ape, and a black ape with an African name and very dark complexion be the evil ape, and that all felt weird to me.
Yeah, it was a little bit How to Train Your Dragon 2 problem there.
Yes! Like, really? Nobody thinks about this? Like, his name will be Caesar, but his name will be Koba. Like, oh, okay. Did you have any feelings about the people?
No. I mean, in terms of Jason Clarke, he's the only one that registered for me at all of the human actors. And there, I was completely convinced of what I suspected in Zero Dark Thirty, that he has screen presence for days, because there really isn't a character.
Yeah.
And I don't even want to talk about Kerry Russell and, you know, the Cornelia, because I can't even talk about it. The gender stuff is too upsetting.
Yeah.
It's like, really? You have carte blanche to to create characters whole from cloth, even though it's a franchise, you know?
And, like, you went out of your way to cast an actor who looks exactly like a perfect genetic combination of Kerry Russell and Jason Clarke, and then turns out to not actually be their son. It's all so weird. I've had, like, unmanageable attraction to Jason Clarke since Public Enemies. Mm. So I mostly just sat there longing for him and thinking, why is this a type I have in movies but would never respond to in real life? The whole Russell Crowe, Jason Clarke thing that they do. I don't know what that is, but...
That's interesting.
And I liked his woodland outfits. Whatever. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I agree. I'm glad he's getting more parts as time goes on.
Yeah.
And I was glad that he did play somebody who's a little bit too stupid to understand that this is not gonna work, or that just every time he showed up, maybe I'll just go to the ape fort one more time, and this time they'll totally understand me. Oh my god, no they won't. What's wrong with you? But he didn't sort of solve that problem on the character's behalf. He made him not get it.
And which actually helps the characterization of Caesar.
Completely.
Because whatever your feelings about Andy Serkis's performance, or just how, you know, fully developed Caesar is, that so adds to his character arc of being too trusting and being too generous.
Yeah.
And all these things that are pretty complicated things to fit into essentially an action movie where your whole, the fascinating thing about it is your whole thrust is not wanting there to be action.
Right.
Which that's an interesting point, I kind of love.
Yeah.
Like, even though the action scenes are well filmed and everything, I love that the whole central arc is, please don't have these big battle scenes that we're looking forward to.
That is such a great summary.
So, anyway. So, I enjoyed that one. I'm just not as bowled over as others are.
Yeah.
Which I think, so I guess we're in the same space on it.
Yeah, and weirdly, like, you know, Begin Again was easily my favorite of these three movies, but it's the last one I would exhort people to make sure they see it in the theater, right? Mm-hmm. I think that all of these are actually really interesting to talk about, but especially these last two.
Yeah. Well, that's all the time we have for today. So we basically recommend all three in completely different ways.
Yeah.
So see which we're so helpful. See whichever ones you feel like seeing, and talk about whichever ones you feel like talking about.
But also, like, see the ones that you don't feel like seeing, because I feel like any of these could actually surprise even someone who thinks this is not their thing.
That's actually true. That is a great lesson to learn. Be more curious about genres you don't love. Oh, anyway, thanks, Nick.
Yeah.
We'll be back shortly with Katie and Joe, I believe, finally, the whole gang back together. And we'll talk about Lucy and Boyhood next time. Bye. Just a boy caught up in dreams and fantasy. Please see me reaching out for someone I can't see. Take my hand, let's see where we wake up tomorrow. Best laid plans, sometimes it's just a one night stand. I'll be damned, Cupid's demanding back his arrow. So let's get drunk on our Tuesday. God, tell us the reason youth is wasted on the young. It's hunting season and the lambs are on the run, searching for meaning. Are we all lost stars trying to light up the dark? Who are we? Just a speck of dust within the galaxy. What is me when I care? The lambs were on the road, searching for me.